Welcome to This Week in the Warner Archive Collection, where we discuss our newest releases. I'm George Feltenstein, and I'm proud to be joined by my colleagues, Matt Patterson and D.W. Ferranti. Seven scintillating additions to the Warner Archive Collection are the subject of this week's podcast, as we have not one, not two, but three fantastic films making their Blu-ray debut, brand new masters created especially for the Warner Archive Collection, especially for you, the loyal listener who supports Warner Archive products on Blu-ray. First and foremost, and very timely, since we're recording this podcast in May, and we're releasing this movie in May, a movie called 7 Days in May, 1964 release with Kirk Douglas, Burt Lancaster, Frederick March, and Ava Gardner, directed by the great John Frankenheimer. And it looks fantastic on Blu-ray and is quite timely, and we're going to be talking about that in a little bit. Now we go from the serious thriller to the outrageous sensibilities of an Evelyn Waugh novel, a screenplay by Christopher Isherwood.
And Terry Southern.
And Terry Southern, the great Terry Southern. And directed by, fresh off his success from Tom Jones, Tony Richardson. This is The Loved One. And funerals in Hollywood were never the same after this movie, released in 1965 with an all-star cast that we'll be telling you about in a moment. And then we have Lawrence Kasdan's great 1988 Oscar winner, The Accidental Tourist, starring William Hurt, Kathleen Turner, and in her Oscar-winning role, Gina Davis. And this is a fantastic film that we're so proud to bring to you on Blu-ray. Then TV on DVD is the next type of focus, as we have The Wayans Brothers Season 2 from 1995 to 96. And it's been many, many years since Season 1 was first released to stores, and people have been asking for The Wayans Brothers ever since. And finally, we answer the call with a release on DVD of Season 2. Last but not least, a short announcement about three films that were in print on DVD, went out of print on DVD, and are now back in print on DVD. Humoresque with John Garfield and Joan Crawford. Baby Doll, the great Tennessee Williams film starring the amazing Carol Baker and Carl Malden, directed by Ilya Kazan. And speaking of Tennessee Williams, we also have Sweet Bird of Youth with Paul Newman and the magnificent Geraldine Page recreating her great Broadway triumph. Let's get with the times and welcome in the month of May with 7 Days in May on Blu-ray.
Now, we just brought this back in print recently on DVD.
Yeah, not too long
ago. And we talked about it on the podcast. And this is one of these films that stands the test of replayability. Because I popped it in and I was like, hey, you know, let me check it out. Let me see how good the Blu-ray looks. And the Blu-ray for the black and white photography is so incredibly crisp that it leapt off, and I watched the whole film before I even realized what was going on.
You can't turn it off, and it's just such exceptional filmmaking
level. It is one of the standout films of American cinema from the 60s, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, the interesting thing about 7 Days in May is it was inspired by events that had occurred in 1961.
Right.
The film itself takes place in the early 70s, in the future of when they were actually making it. But the elements of the film and the currents and the cross currents are still relevant today. But it's also such a great blueprint of economy in filmmaking. There's not a wasted line of dialogue or a wasted scene in this film. And it all just moves the narrative forward at this propulsive rate, but still gives time for all these characters who, a lot of times in political thrillers, you know, the chiefs of staff and the aide-de-camps, they're all very much ciphers. Everyone's a human being in this film, even the bad guys.
And the caliber of acting is just without peer.
Well, there's very much a project that Kirk Douglas ramrodded through his own production company and on his own shoulders. But he tells these stories about the shooting of his film where he's watching Burt Lancaster and going, oh, no one's going to remember my role in this.
But he holds the film together.
Oh, absolutely.
So well.
You know, although he's a very successful soldier in the film, he's also very much like the common person called upon to do something extraordinary, as is the Edmund O'Brien character.
And this was a best-selling novel at the time.
It was 61.
It was on the bestseller list for quite some time, so it was one of those kinds of thrillers that had to be made into a film, and at that time could be made into a film and commercially successful.
And it was a film that, interestingly enough, John Kennedy very much wanted to be made into a film. And we should mention Rod Serling wrote the screenplay, just so the bona fides of this production are clear.
And the hook of this is that Kirk Douglas stumbles upon a plot where he, a literal plot to have there be a military coup taking over the presidency of the United States. And the way that it unfolds, and they have literally 1 week, it's like it's a countdown. It's such a great use of cinema as a snapshot. And Dan, you were saying how each of, and there are so many characters in this and so many strands and so many little plot threads. Now this might be tackled like on television.
But you would do like a 7-hour miniseries.
Yeah, but this is so economically well told. It's almost like you wouldn't want to change anything.
No, and every single thread ties up in the end. It's one of the tightest climaxes. It sets up a very difficult problem, but it solves it within its own narrative threads in a very elegant way.
Now, this is coming only 2 years after John Frankenheimer blew everybody away with the Manchurian Candidate. And how do you top that in terms of political thriller? I can't say that this film tops that, but it equals it.
Absolutely.
It equals it. It is a powerful film. It isn't as well known as The Manchurian Candidate.
It definitely
deserves to be.
Yeah. I mean, Manchurian Candidate is such a towering figure.
And it got remade.
Of cinema that I think that this movie gets a little bit of a short shrift in comparison, but this is every bit as stunning. Even when you know kind of where it's going, the pieces, the weave of it is so great. That's what enables you, and what is great about the Blu-ray is you can watch it multiple times.
Now, this is a brand new master created especially for the Blu-ray, so it is representative of the technology we have today that brings us amazing imagery in high definition on Blu-ray, and we really urge you to purchase this. But we also want to mention that if you haven't seen this film and you want to test it out before you buy it, that there is a sale right now on iTunes for rental as well as purchase, but for rental, you can rent this at a very, very low price and see it for yourself, along with another great political thriller in our, well, I shouldn't really call it a thriller, another great politically minded film.
Political dysfunctional dramas?
There you go.
Charged.
Another amazing film that is unfortunately too timely at the present time, and it's only 60 years old. This is Ilya Kazan's masterpiece, A Face in the Crowd, starring Patricia Neal and Andy Griffith, and written by the great Bud Schulberg. A Face in the Crowd and 7 Days in May are part of a duo that is on sale at iTunes from Warner Brothers right now. So if you want to add them to your digital library, we urge you to do so.
I'll just say it's on sale until the 24th of May in 2017, because if you're listening to this later, it won't be on sale anymore.
And together, the two films is a great 1-2 punch sort of a pedagoguery and paranoia. Burt Lancaster really delivers a chilling performance in 7 Days in May. But Andy Griffith, if you only love Andy Griffith, as you should, because of Sheriff Andy, you will be blown away by A Face in the Crowd, because he's amazing in this. Lonesome Rose, the character he plays, is about unlike Sheriff Andy as you can imagine.
So we just want to clarify, 7 Days in May, brand new on Blu-ray, but also part of an iTunes sale in May, along with A Face in the Crowd. So we wanted to clarify that and let you know there are multiple opportunities out there for entertainment. Our next Blu-ray release is also a film in black and white from an era where most films were in color, and is about as different from 7 Days in May as you can get, but brilliant.
If any film deserved to be in black and white,
yeah,
when color was an option, it is definitely the black comedy.
I can't imagine this film in color, just like I can't imagine Psycho in color.
This is one of these films where you're watching it and you're aware that it was made in the mid-60s. It's remarkable that it got made. It would be remarkable for this film to be made today, much less in 1965. And it is a great movie.
Now, The Loved One is based off of a novel.
By Evelyn Waugh.
And the novel was about his trip. He was an Englishman, and he was coming out. He was paid to pitch one of his books.
Brideshead Revisited.
Yeah, to movie studios. And he didn't really sell the book. He didn't want to. But he was enamored by Hollywood culture, and very specifically, the Forest Lawn Cemetery. Yep. And that led him to write this short novel immediately afterwards. And he was clearly on fire. And if you have ever been to L.A. and visited Forest Lawn and studied some of the, like Amy McPherson, some of the religious people in L.A. from the 20s and 30s, that all gets channeled into this satire that then bursts forth onto film. It's pretty unforgettable way.
Well, this was a film that the marketing department at MGM, the studio that produced the film, the marketing department came up with a slogan that's very famous. They called it the motion picture with something to offend everyone.
And it's true.
And it's very true. And many, many years later, there are scenes in this movie that are shocking. My particular favorite scene involves the great Rod Steiger as Mr. Joy Boy, and particularly when he brings young Anjanette Comer home to meet his mother.
It's almost like a John Waters scene.
I was just going to say.
I was going to concur, because it's the closest you get to Edith Massey until you meet Edith Massey in Pink Flamingos 7 years later. The mother of Mrs. Joy Boy and her particular relationship with television commercials is worthy of the most genius wit of cinema I've ever seen.
Now, it's pretty much impossible to do this film in short when it comes to the loved one. But
you can't.
You can't. But Robert Morse plays a young wannabe poet who comes to the States to see his uncle, who works for a studio, and is fired by his boss, who's played by Roddy McDowall. And then Jean Gielgud is his uncle, and his uncle kills himself, which then leads our young would-be poet into the world of funeral homes in Los Angeles and a young lady named Amy Thanatogenes.
So you get a cast that includes Jonathan Winters, Liberace, Milton Berle, Tab Hunter. It's an incredible amalgam of talents.
Jonathan Winters in dual roles.
And one of the things that's most interesting about this movie, I think, is that the John Gielgud character is employed at a motion picture studio where he is summarily dismissed. And this movie was made in 1965 and made by MGM and shot at MGM at a time when a lot of the long-term MGM executives that had been there since the 20s and 30s were getting the axe. The axes didn't heavily fall until the studio was purchased by Kirk Corian in 1969, and then they really flew. But before then,
I just kept thinking of that when I'm watching this.
It actually foretold what would become a horrific situation.
And the same way.
In the mid-60s, it was happening that people who had been there since the 20s and 30s were being shown the door after working there for 30 or 40 years, and John Gielgud is walking through the Thalberg building of MGM, and you even get to see their old parking lot that they had in front of the Thalberg building and the stores that lined on Washington Boulevard, which were gone by the early 70s.
And one of the secrets to how this film got made is it was produced by Haskell Wexler, who also shot it, which is why it looks so amazing. And speaking of the location stuff, there's a lot of really great location photography in this film. There's Forest Lawn, the MGM studio, there's Bronson Canyon. There's a lot of really, really great location stuff that looks better than ever.
It was shot in black and white on purpose, but it was a fairly substantially budgeted film, and it was part of a co-production deal that MGM had with the Filmways organization at the time. And Martin Ransohoff's organization, along with producer John Callis, who would later go on to be one of the heads of Warner Brothers here in the 70s, and then made some great films with Mike Nichols at Columbia in later years. And anyway, John Callis was very integral in bringing the talent together on this film, including Haskell Wexler. And we have a featurette on the disc that was created for the DVD release, which happened about 11 years ago. And Robert Morse is in there, and so is the late Haskell Wexler, and they talk about how this film got made. And the film was not well received upon release. It headed to television awfully quickly, but it has subsequently become a cult favorite, and people to this day, some people think it's their favorite movie of all time. Other people are a little underwhelmed by it simply because they don't understand it. But if you are a sophisticated person with a really ranker sense of humor, I think The Loved One is perfect cinematic going. And the star spotting is pretty impressive as well.
But you actually point out something good in that sometimes the best satires that live the longest are not initially received. You know, that's a long history of that genre and that it takes a while for it to really sink in. And that is definitely this one.
This film was way ahead of its time. And it is a remarkable achievement that it was made, when it was made, and how it was made. And to get somebody of the caliber of John Gielgud to play the part that he played, everybody is so good. There's a multitude of Oscar winner and nominees. And Robert Morse was a little out of place playing that title leading role. And he'll talk about it in the featurette because his fake British accent comes and goes throughout the movie.
He's still charming.
And this is not to undermine him at all, because he is one of the greats of the entertainment industry, both on film, television, and of course the stage.
And doing cartoon voices.
That's right. But he'll be the first one, and he talks about it in the featurette on the disc, that his accent was a little bit wavering during the movie. The amount of famous people that come and go and pop in, Liberace, I believe, is a coffin salesman, if I'm correct.
Sort of the package salesman.
Yeah.
Like the whole deal. Yeah. It is not the same kind of Liberace you see in Sincerely Yours, but it's more like the Liberace you see in When the Boys Meet the Girls, just without the singing. This is definitely a must for Blu-ray. A brand new master. We had a very nice master for the DVD, and that was a 1080p master, and it could have been a Blu-ray if we didn't care about making everything look great. But we went back to the original film elements and gave it a brand new, beautiful master, and we're very proud of the disc, and it's available now. Now we're going to travel 20 years into the future, to the late 1980s, and a film based on a great book that won the hearts of a lot of filmgoers. It was very successful upon the time of its release and continues to remain an audience favorite. That is Lawrence Kasdan's film of Anne Tyler's book, The Accidental Tourist, which stars the great William Hurt. Kathleen Turner plays his estranged wife, and Gina Davis plays a young woman who comes into his life, who changes his life. And Gina Davis earned Best Supporting Actress Oscar for her performance.
And you know, just doing some background research on the film and then Gina Davis winning the Oscar, 88 was a pretty good year for cinema.
Oh, great.
Looking at the list of all the films, I was like, wow, that was a good year.
A lot of great movies came from all the different studios. And this was one of the biggest hits for Warner Brothers in 1988. And its arrival on Blu-ray is long overdue. And the beautiful new master is really something to look at, and equally fun as the film itself and touching as the film itself. There are lots of lifted scenes, which is another way of referring to deleted scenes, but there are almost 40 minutes of them. And considering that the movie is of quite substantial length, you see the pains that Lawrence Kasdan went to tell the story, be faithful to the book, and yet keep the running time where there really isn't a wasted frame. You were talking about that before.
This was a tough one adaptation-wise because it isn't exactly, it's an emotional ride.
And it's not linear.
Not plot heavy in terms of what goes on. The story itself is very simple. The couple, their child is murdered. And
don't give away any spoilers.
That's not a spoiler. But that leads to a breakup in the marriage. And then he has to rebuild his life. Yeah, I mean, that is the plot.
A young lady and a dog very slowly bring him out of himself. But the whole film is his journey from being emotionally distant to becoming a full person again. That was a somewhat common theme in a lot of movies from this period, is the emotionally distant male getting in touch. I don't know what was going on culturally, but I do remember it.
This book was lying around the house. This was one of my mom's favorites. And I read it as a young man because, of course, I related to it quite heavily.
And you wanted to move to Baltimore.
This Baltimore is somewhere on the spectrum between the Baltimore of John Waters and The Wire. This is a different Baltimore. As a kid, I was like, oh, the guy who did Raiders and Empire Strikes Back is going to do this book that my mom had lying around the house. It was just really kind of an interesting thing to see. And
I like to think of him more as the guy who did The Big Chill.
There is a funny circular thing to Kasdan's career because he sort of has come out of semi-retirement to add his talents once again to A Long Time Ago, A Galaxy Far, Far Away.
Yeah, it is interesting to think of the fact that Kathleen Turner and William Hurt both kind of made their imprint cinematically with Body Heat, and they're 7 years later, they're reunited on Accidental Tourist.
And they're so different.
They're so different. This film is unjustly overlooked. It's almost on the cusp of being 30 years old, which I find terrifying. And it is also remarkable because it feels completely contemporary.
And the packing advice that he gives is one that I still follow. I realized, of course, watching this movie, how much I'm like, oh my God, I pack exactly like that except the suit.
Now we go from the 80s on Blu-ray to TV on DVD and a long-requested resumption of a sitcom hit with the Wayans Brothers, Season 2 from 1995 and 96, making its arrival on DVD about 6 years after Season 1 first appeared on DVD. Was it worth the wait? You betcha.
And Season 2 of the Wayans Brothers is very much sort of a reset. Still keeps Pops and the Lobby, but now Sean gets a job running the newsstand because Cliff gets a heart attack and dies. And then, so everyone sort of gets located, becomes much more workplacey, but they still have the apartment.
It's a new building.
Yeah, it's the Niedermeyer. And then we introduce ourselves to a new romantic interest, and we get a lot of good play from the Lobby Guard.
I really feel that we've been tackling a lot of the WB's back catalog now, and it's a lot of fun to visit because the Wayans Brothers was hot at the time.
And, oh, absolutely.
And, you know, they've gone on to do, I mean, like, we've been releasing all these sitcoms where, you know, it's like these people have gone on to do kind of interesting
sitcoms
things.
Sitcoms and animation from a very beloved channel.
Yeah.
So we're glad to bring you the Wayans Brothers now on DVD.
And what's really engaging about, I mean, the show's very much set up like a sitcom, but the writers also leave a lot of room. Sean's kind of stuck being the straight guy.
Yeah.
But they give Marlon plenty of leeway for him just to, like, do crazy improv, and he, of course, is hysterical.
And the opening credits alone sort of show
lay
you,
that out.
Yeah, yeah, that expectation, because it's like they have these big Afro wigs on at the beginning, and there's a theme where they're kind of making fun of 70s sitcoms. Then they're helping an old woman across the street, and she gets hit by a bus. So that just tells you where the sense of humor comes from.
There's no sense of humor in our next title, because we're going to talk about really beloved melodrama from the 1940s with a screenplay by none other than Clifford Odets.
And perhaps you've been watching a show called Feud, because Humoresque was name-checked in that.
That's right.
Heck yeah.
And this is, of course, John Garfield in a phenomenal performance as a young violinist trying to make his way to the top. And the film goes on almost an hour before you meet his sponsor and soon-to-be love interest, played by the recent Oscar winner Joan Crawford in Humoresque. And one of the things this film has in common with a film that came a little bit before, Rhapsody in Blue, which we've also released on DVD through the Warner Archive, is that Oscar Levant plays Oscar Levant, even though he's not Oscar Levant by name as he is in Rhapsody in Blue. There are interesting aspects to this in that I believe Clifford Odets was involved with an early screenplay treatment of Rhapsody in Blue, and that kind of explains how Oscar Levant ended up in this movie. It's a very interesting trajectory, but this is masterful filmmaking. It's a definite soap opera sudser. Great music by Franz Waxman. And the violin playing was done by a very young Isaac Stern. One of the most amazing things about this film is John Garfield could not play the violin, and the geniuses here at Warner Brothers, we had geniuses even back then, in 1946, came up with a situation using mirrors and camera angles so it looked like Garfield was playing when in fact it was actually somebody else's hand and somebody else on the violin.
Wow.
And they pulled it off brilliantly.
I read it was three people, like one guy for each hand. And
they used every trick in the book.
But so great.
What was interesting was when Barbara Streisand was doing The Prince of Tides, she needed to see how they did that in Humoresque in order to do something similar in The Prince of Tides.
Oh, so that's funny.
There's always an interesting backstory behind so many of these films. So Humoresque was in print, was out of print, and is now back in print, and as Dan so brightly mentioned, Humoresque was recently mentioned in the FX television series Feud about Joan Crawford and Betty Davis, so we highly recommend Humoresque. 10 years later, here at Warner Brothers, a very different kind of movie was being made on a much lower budget with a much more realistic story to be told, but it's from the pen of Tennessee Williams, and this was an original screenplay, not a play that was adapted for the screen, but an original screenplay called Baby Doll. And it was directed by Ilya Kazan, and it starred the then unknown Carol Baker as the young wife of Carl Malden. And under the direction of Ilya Kazan, it made film history. And this was considered very controversial.
This is one of the precursor codebreaker films.
When you watch it,
codebreaker, I don't mean spy. I mean motion picture code.
This definitely dances over the line.
It's a given that this film has been known as a classic.
Yeah.
From the moment that it came out. We're so happy to bring it back in print. And lastly, but certainly not least, one of Williams' great plays made a transition from stage to screen, and the leading lady went with the film, as did the leading man, but the leading man did not play the leading man in the film. The film is Sweet Bird of Youth, and the leading lady is Geraldine Page, but her leading man on the screen was the great Paul Newman, and he is magnificent in this film. But the leading man on the stage was Geraldine Page's real-life husband, Rip Torn, who has a supporting role in the film and is quite marvelous. Also quite marvelous in this film is Ed Begley, Sr., who won an Academy Award for his supporting actor performance, and he's quite despicable and remarkable in this film. Geraldine Page plays a faded movie queen who is spending a very long bender with a gigolo. And it sounds like it's going to be salacious, but it is before the code. So there's only a degree to how salacious it can be. And the screen did its best. I think this is a little more faithful to the play than Cat on a Hot Tin Roof was to that play.
Yes, but like Streetcar, we have a very different climax.
Oh. Right.
But this climax is actually, if you're not aware of the play, this climax works.
Just a wonderful entertainment if you're into the drama. And this is dramatic.
And it was very highly lauded and acclaimed upon its release. And it was just too much of a sin for it to be out of print. So we brought it back and now it's available.
And speaking of Feud, also name checked.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah.
Geraldine Page was one of the actresses who Joan Crawford would have accepted had she won the Academy Award so that it would get Betty Davis all angry. But that's a story for another time. But what we do want to talk about right now are letters. We're really, really hungry for consumer letters at this moment. And the reason is because we have something very special to give away while they last. And that is we have 1973 international re-release posters of the 1967 film The Dirty Dozen. So these are actual 44-year-old posters of a 50-year-old movie, the original artwork, and Dan is going to give them away to lucky people that send us a self-addressed stamped envelope and request one with a letter.
And not to belabor the point, but The Dirty Dozen was directed by
Robert Aldridge,
who directed
Whatever Happened to Baby Jane,
which was the subject of
Feud.
We can't escape from it, no matter how hard we try.
Those two ladies leave a very big footprint.
Oh, what a legacy. And if you want to send us a letter, please send it to Warner Archive Podcast, 3400 Riverside Drive, B, as in boy, 160-4, Burbank, California, 91522. And this comes from Park Ridge, Illinois. It is from Jack. Dear Warner Archive, I am an 18-year-old classic film fan writing to you from Park Ridge, Illinois. It's always a treat to order a DVD from you guys and watch it on TV, and I'm writing for several reasons. One, I want to wish you a happy 8th birthday. Sorry I'm late, but better late than never. I can't believe you guys have been releasing the best of the best for this long. It seems like yesterday when I first saw an advertisement on TCM saying you guys were a new way to get classic films. I'm glad you guys are still manufacturing DVDs and have no sign of stopping anytime soon. Another reason why I'm writing is to thank you for all the classic films you've released. Being a classic film fan is not easy, but you guys make it a lot easier for us. In middle school, I saw these three, 1936, on TCM and fell head over heels in love with it and knew I had to have it. When I found out it was never released on DVD, I was disappointed. After that, I was able to catch it on TV twice, but that was it. Then in February of 2016, I stumbled upon a Warner Archive DVD on Amazon. I immediately bought it, and my mother was mad because I used her credit card to buy it, although I paid her back later. I hope you guys keep releasing movies and TV shows because I can't get enough of them. Keep up the good work. One more reason I'm writing to you is to ask a few questions about releases. I noticed a while back that you released The Breaking Point, 1950, and Miracle of Morgan's Creek, 1944, on Warner Archive, but they're out of print and I can't find them on your website or Amazon. My question is, why did you pull these movies? Another question, will there be a Huckleberry Hound Volume 2? Warner Brothers released Volume 1 a long time ago, and according to sources on the internet, there were more episodes, but this is based off people's memories, not facts. Also, what about Quickdraw McGraw and Wally Gator? I know there might have been plans a while ago and wonder if you guys are considering it. My last question pertains to a film that you have in your library but haven't released, The Sea Wolf, 1940. It was directed by Michael Curtiz and stars John Garfield. My question is, are you planning to give The Sea Wolf the Warner Archive treatment anytime soon? Finally, thank you for taking time to read my letter. I know it's long, but when I find out you could write to Warner Archive, I had so many things to ask. I hope to enjoy your releases for countless years to come. Thank you sincerely, Jack.
Well, that's a very nice letter.
Yes.
And we wanted to thank you for your support.
And any 18-year-olds that are fans of physical media, we're happy to hear from.
Especially classic films.
Yes.
Yeah, this is really well written.
So sometimes we have to withdraw films from distribution because of rights issues or distribution issues where we've had films for a particular time. Specifically in the case of The Miracle of Morgan's Creek, that was a Paramount film, and Warner Brothers had a distribution agreement with Paramount that had a limited term. That term has ended, but I'm sure the film will be available again from another source. The Breaking Point is not available at the present time, but it may become available at a later time. But there was one other question. Yes, The Sea Wolf. My answer to the availability of The Sea Wolf is to quote Bugs Bunny and say, it could be. The animation that you asked about, we don't have anything to announce on Huckleberry Hound or Wally Gator. We can tell you the likelihood of there being any Quickdraw McGraw is pretty limited because of some clearance issues. Other than that, we do plan to continue to release a lot more classic animation and feature films, and we really thank you for your support. Now, Matt, you look like you have yet another letter.
We have another letter, and this one has a self-addressed stamped envelope, so that goes to Dan.
Oh, my goodness.
Who handles the fulfillment end. This is from Garden Grove, and this is from Douglas, and this is written in many colors of colored pencil. We here at home really like that guy Matt and let him talk more. Bogey's Bedpan Brigade.
It's not gonna happen. If he had said something about Alan Jenkins, I might have let this guy Matt talk more, but as much as I love Bogey, it's not enough.
and then printed below that in Helvetica font, can you talk about what colors were used for sets and clothing when they were filming in black and white? Were all actors dressed in shades of gray? What colors worked best? What famous films filmed in black and white would really surprise people to learn their true colors?
Excellent question.
Well, I think that, first of all, they shot using colors that would show up well in black and white. I'm led to think the first thing that I thought of when you were reading that was the famous red dress that Betty Davis wears in Jezebel, a very black and white movie, despite the despicable decision to colorize it back in the late 80s, which none of us here at Warner Brothers were responsible for. But happily, colorized versions of movies are no longer distributed anywhere around this company. But the point of it is that certain colors didn't show up in black and white, and costume designers and set designers and art directors, when they were designing for black and white films, would pick colors accordingly that would look really well.
Right, a very famous example of this, I mean, it's for TV, but they were shooting on film, is the George Reeves first season Superman suit was not blue and red. And then right. They had to make a whole new suit when they switched over to color because they had designed the original suit for shooting in black and white.
Right.
One of the common tricks is because whites don't come out well, they would use yellows or cyans, just the way the lighting and the reflection. And so if you did see those in life, but a lot of you wouldn't actually notice that because people don't think that way when they see those colors.
And a lot of greens, red is sort of a bone shade.
Yeah, and so they would alter the colors a little bit, but it's interesting. And when you do get color photography and can see it and compare it to black and white, it is kind of revelatory, but the costumes were not, and the sets, things were not actually painted in black and white, except for maybe some German expressionism.
That may be possible, but the interesting opportunities come when there are, aside from the obvious Wizard of Oz, there are a few films in black and white that have color sequences. And you get to see what the characters look like and their costumes look like in color. Shine on Harvest Moon with Dennis Morgan and Ann Sheridan is one of the non-famous examples of that. Another example of that is The Secret Garden with Margaret O'Brien, yes, which is part of the Warner Archive Collection. So that gives you an idea of what was done. And also, they would frequently shoot color photographs for Sunday newspaper magazines called rotogravures.
Yeah.
Going back years and years before color filmmaking became the status quo. So you can see actual color photographs of black and white movies as opposed to colorized lobby cards of black and white movies and see what the characters were actually wearing in those movies on those rare occasions where someone was snapping a color film. There are also examples, and this is one of my favorites, is that Ira Gershwin was on the set of Shall We Dance and shot color home movies while Fred Astaire was dancing. And the Astaire Rogers black and white RKO movies are famous for their black and white look. And you get to see specifically the Slap That Bass number, how the costumes and the sets were really designed and what they looked like in color, even though they were never meant to be seen that way. So it's a very, very good question. But there's a lot more documentation about that in a lot of cinematic history books. And there's also Ori Kelly, great costume designer. Ori Kelly recently had a posthumous autobiography published, and he goes into great detail about how he created a lot of the costumes that he made for mostly black and white movies. So very, very good question, and we thank you for the inquiry.
Well, that's it.
So we can't have anything for Matt to say anymore, but we promise he'll be talking next week to his heart's content as we end this Warner podcast and promise that we'll be back next week with another all-new Warner Archive podcast. But until then, I am George Feldenstein.
I'm Matt Patterson.
The Guru Brahmin.
Thanks for listening and look forward to the next Warner Archive podcast.